good horse, I call you my shiny black bears.
When you see around the globe the maldistribution of wealth, the desperate plight of millions of people in underdeveloped countries, when you see so few haves and so many have-nots, when you see the greed and the concentration of power within, did you ever have a moment of doubt about capitalism and whether greed's a good idea to run on?
Well, first of all, tell me, is there some society you know that doesn't run on greed? You think Russia doesn't run on greed? You think China doesn't run on greed? What is greed? Of course, none of us are greedy. It's only the other fellow who's greedy. The world runs on individuals pursuing their separate interests.
You're listening to episode 572 of Unwelcome Guests, Monopoly and Money. I'm Robin Upton, and that was Milton Friedman. Thought we'd start the show with an arch capitalist for a change. He's apparently explaining that he sees no difference between greed and self-interest. I don't have a problem with people who are self-interested. I have more of a problem with people who are greedy, and I have even more of a problem with people who can't distinguish the two. But under capitalism, of course, to be rational means to be greedy. To want as much as you can get for yourself and give as little to anyone else. Well, that's in the economic sphere. There are those who say that you can behave like that and yet you can be law-abiding, because somehow that doesn't transfer, and you're, as a corporation, somehow motivated to follow the rules, and you're self-interested only within those rules. This seems to me to be a bit of a stretch. I know plenty of people who, when playing ordinary games for fun, enjoy trying to break the rules to see what they can get away with and increase their chance of winning. Now, how much more likely are you to break rules if you can earn a lot of money by doing so? Or if you know that the other company is likely to be breaking rules as well, and if you don't, you may go under. You may lose your job. You may lose your company. Well, that's called the prisoner's dilemma, assuming that these rules should be followed, and the Nash equilibrium, I hope I'm not getting too technical, what it means is the result of people behaving in a self-interested fashion is that nobody follows the rules. But what are these rules anyway? These are laws. Are these in fact true representations of what people want? Or are they bits of paper who have been signed off by officials with that power? Well, we heard in episode 570 that the law seems to be pretty flexible these days. And I think the phrase campaign contributions says a lot about how the law gets made. I'm not even going to go there, but we're looking particularly at problems of the capitalist system. Our third presentation this week is Ellen Brown speaking on her book Web of Debt about the money system, that one area in which no competition is tolerated or even contemplated. Our second piece this week is Edward Griffin on the meaning and mythology of monopoly capitalism. But we're going to start the show with the following recording of Howie Hawkins, a Green Party activist in Syracuse, New York. He was speaking at the New York Green Fest in August 2011. This is courtesy of Wilton Vaught from Essential Dissent. His website, essentialdissent.blogspot.com, features a video of the following recording, and I'll link to it from this show's webpage, unwelcomeguests.net/572.
I put the title on this, Ecological Socialism versus Capitalist Exterminism, and I'll talk about two senses of exterminism. It's a term that came out of the campaign for nuclear disarmament from E.P. Thompson. What I want to do is lay out some propositions, and the first set are about what's wrong with capitalism, from our point of view as Greens, and then how socialism, particularly ecological socialism, can provide solutions. So I'm going to go through 10 things that I think we need to think about capitalism as being wrong, and they're systemic. The one that is most prominent historically is exploitation, theft of our labor that's institutionalized. It's unjust. So we produce, and there's the fruit of that labor, but then the capitalists take a portion of it. And there are two classic ways of explaining that. One's the labor theory of value, which Marx, that's what people think of, but it really comes through all the classical economists, Adam Smith, Ricardo, John Stuart Mill, those people. And the basic idea is that the value created isn't appropriated by the people that create it. They get a part of it as wages, and the rest is appropriated by the people that own the tools, the means of production that the people are working with. And it's controversial whether that actually explains the prices. And if you want to find a recent argument that it is, you should look up two guys from England, Cockshott and Cockrell, who have sort of done an empirical analysis of where we are right now. And their basic analysis is in the industrial economies, the workers are getting about half of what they produce, and the rest is appropriated by the capitalists. There's another critique that sort of a different tradition, and that's the labor theory of property. And this starts with Proudhon, you know, the French anarchist. And I think it's been best explained recently by David Ellerman. And if you look up his writings, the basic idea there is forget about prices and value. Just think of it in terms of property rights. If you are producing something, and the classic definition of property or the right to property is it's the fruit of your labor, you're entitled to dispose of it as you want, but somebody else is getting it. So you can critique exploitation from either of those bases. And this is a problem that the classical economists considered central. I mean, their whole thing from Smith right up to Marx was how do you get rid of unearned income? And they were going after the landlords and the moneylenders. And when we get to the end of these 10 propositions about capitalism, we'll find out we still got that problem. A second one that became really important for lefties in the 60s was alienation, which Marx talked about a lot in his younger writings. And the basic idea there is we produce products and put them into an economic system that then comes back upon us as if, and we have no control over it. So the whole system's alienated, our labor's alienated, and the process of disalienating that is a problem of creating a really free society. So that has to do with freedom. Capitalism is an unfree society for people that work. A third thing that's also been big, particularly for the traditional left, are periodic crises, business cycles, boom and bust, scarcity and gluts. And because the system is unplanned and unpredictable, it creates economic insecurity, particularly for people at the bottom of the economic hierarchy. So that's a third problem with capitalism. That leads, particularly if you read more recent analyses in the tradition of monopoly capitalism, Paul Sweezy and Paul Barron wrote this book in the mid-60s, which had a lot of influence on the left at that time and has been carried forward by these people at Monthly Review. And that is stagnation. And the basic argument there is capitalism has been able to grow when it needed to build out a technological complex. You know, railroads and the steam engine at one time. The first wave of suburbanization with the automobile. The post-war expansion of suburbanization and consumer goods. The problem is once you build that out, the capitalists run out of profitable outlets for tangible investment, and the economy stagnates. And where that leads to is financialization, which I'll talk about in a minute. So periodic crises and stagnation are problems that are intrinsic to the way the system operates. Another problem is inequality. That starts with the exploitation, and you create class polarization, and that integrates with other forms of oppression like racism, which if you look at it historically, there had been ethnic prejudice against groups against each other and rivalries. But under capitalism, it becomes profitable to dominate one group to the exclusion of others. And if you look at the history of slavery in the United States, you see African slaves, European indentured servants having similar status till you get to Bacon's Rebellion, when the slaves and the indentured servants got together and rebelled against the elite. It wasn't all, you know, a good thing, because they were also trying to take land from the Indians. But the elites realized that the poor whites and the poor blacks could take their power. And that's when they started making racism systematic and institutionalized. And all that flows from a system that generates inequality. So another thing, you've got competition between companies in the market and also states, where the states support their companies, and that generates war and militarism. And if you look at the history of capitalism, particularly in the 20th century, the most warlike century in human history, with the most deaths, the most wars, the most weapons, you can see how that's developed historically. And that's where the first sense of using the word exterminism for capitalism comes in. E.P. Thompson, who was one of the people that sort of founded the New Left in the 50s in Britain, a famous historian, when we were in the campaign for nuclear disarmament, which here sort of manifests most broadly as the freeze movement in the 80s. That was at a time when the missile crisis in Germany, one of the big issues that got the German Greens going, was at its highlight. So there's this famous article, Notes on Exterminism, The Last Stage of Civilization, by Edward Thompson. And it starts out, "Comrades, we need a cogent theoretical and class analysis of the present war crisis. Yes, but to structure an analysis in a consecutive rational manner may be at the same time to impose a consequential rationality upon the object of analysis. What if the object is irrational? What if events are willed by no single causative historical logic, but are simply the product of a messy inertia? What if a collection of fragmented forces, political and military formations, ideological imperatives, weapons technologies, are what's driving the situation, like World War I? You know, one assassination and suddenly all these secret alliances manifest themselves and we've got a world war. The point is, you can look at the logic of capitalism and see how it generates war and militarism, but then you get things that are thrust up by that, like we had during the Cold War, militarized oligarchies competing, and the nukes on a hairline trigger, anything could set it off. We're really still in that situation. It's just not as prominent. So this system generates irrationalities, and then irrationality can take over. And it's not like you can go from A to B to C and end up with nuclear war, but you've created the conditions when something could spark it off. So war and militarism is a real serious problem with capitalism. And then this is what's been called the second contradiction of capitalism by James O'Connor, who began to talk about the first contradiction between socialized cooperative production and privatized appropriation, exploitation, and the things that followed from that. The second contradiction is capitalism depends on growth. The logic for every corporation is grow or die. It built into the system is endless growth, and that's incompatible with a steady state, sustainable economy that lives off the income from the environment, the environmental services the environment generates. What we have is a system that's basically eating up the capital, the principal. And that creates, so that's why capitalism is incompatible with an ecological, sustainable society. And another thing that happens there is the externalization of costs, which is in the interest of every firm. That's both onto nature and society at large. Pollution, various forms of ecological destruction, the market and the price system doesn't measure that. It might be a bad impact down the road in time, and they're only looking at current costs. Plus, it's in their interest to, as much as possible, not internalize those costs in the firm, but externalize them onto society and nature. And then they also use their power to get favors from the state to socialize the risk and privatize the profits. And so that's the way they basically take the surplus for themselves and leave the cost with the rest of us. So number nine is monopoly capital. One of the other things that flow from this system of competition and trying to get bigger in order to compete is concentration and centralization of capital. And what happens then is you don't have competition between firms by price, which is the classical model you get in Economics 101. because the prices are set by the leading firm in an oligopolistic market. And most of the world economy is that kind of economy. It's not competitive. If you look at, this is monthly review, folks who followed this, this is the current issue or next to current issue. On the internationalization of monopoly capital, they had a previous article about just the extent of it, and that's going to be a book they're coming out, kind of updating the monopoly capital analysis. And they provide the empirical numbers on how monopolized the economy is, and it's monopolized in ways we don't think about, like outsourcing by big corporations to firms in various parts of the world. They're not formally owned, but they're controlled. You know, Walmart basically tells people, go to China and produce where it's cheaper, or we're not going to buy from you because we want lower costs. And so that means they're not competing by price. They're competing by product differentiation, Coke and Pepsi, advertising, and also by favors they can get from the state. You know, for example, I'm UPS, Teamster, FedEx, got a favorite labor law passed. So for them to organize, they got to have the whole country vote in one organizing election rather than hub by hub, which the rest of the transportation industry does because they got regulated as an airline, even though they're a brick-and-mortar, you know, truck thing mostly. And so that's how FedEx got a special favor from the state, and that's how they're competing with UPS. The other thing that happens is that you get these vested interests because they're so big and powerful, they can get what they want from the state. So, you know, full employment, everybody says they're for full employment, but these capitalists really don't want that because they want us to be insecure and willing to accept less wages. So while you can draw a mathematical model of how you could get full employment in a private capitalist economy, they're going to lobby against that because it's against their interests. You can figure out the same thing with fossil fuels. You know, you can, you know, with a carbon tax and other things, figure out how you could get to green energy in a capitalist economy. But the problem is you've got these vested interests that screw up any model that you might draw up. Another thing is the medical industrial complex, where they have a vested interest in keeping this totally irrational system we have and use their lobbying power to get it. So those are ways in which, you know, you hear the, and it's in the news and the cable talk shows all the time about, you know, capitalism and competition gets you to lower prices and, you know, there's freedom to enter, but we're not in that kind of a system anymore. It's a monopolized system. And what it's become is, and this is what, you know, this new book on updating a monopoly capital, they call it monopoly finance capital. What happens when you have stagnation and they're not profitable outlets and tangible investment is they start speculating in financial instruments. So, you know, instead of taking all the subsidies we've given them in these bailouts recently and investing in new means of production to employ people and produce goods and services, they're using that for commodity plays, stock plays, bond plays, currency plays. And what they're doing is just rearranging who owns the assets we've already got rather than creating new assets. And that has become, to such an extent, an important trend in the economy that corporate profits have increased from single digits in the financial sector back in the 1970s to over 40% since 2000. And so this financial economy, you know, it creates asset bubbles and bursts and busts. And so all the stimulus we've had, a lot of it's just gone into the cash reserves of these corporations and banks who are using it to concentrate further their ownership of what we already got. So there's $1.5 trillion in lendable reserves in the banks. There's $2 trillion in the corporations. And then the wealthy, the individuals, the households, have $13 trillion. And they're not investing in new production. To the extent they are, to the extent, you know, the tax breaks for working class people, you know, like our little payroll tax deduction we're getting right now, is being spent on goods because of the trade agreements, you know, it's stimulating China rather than the United States. So these are a lot of the problems that we get with under monopoly finance capital, where we are right now. And one of the ironies of this is that, you know, I mentioned the classical economists were trying to get rid of unearned income. I mean, Marx really thought the industrial capitalists would rein in the financial capitalists, and then that would be how resources or investment would be allocated to expanding industrial production. You know, everybody focuses on Volume 1, which is about exploitation, but Volume 2 and especially Volume 3 were about the financial sector and, you know, how eventually the capitalists would take over. And that turned out not to be a right prediction, at least to this point. because finance capital is taking back over the whole domination of the economy. So there you've had 10 propositions about what's wrong with capitalism and why Greens, as Greens, we should oppose it. So let's talk briefly about alternatives. And so what is socialism? You know, the popular sense is if it's government, it's socialist. If it's private, it's capitalist. And I heard this on MSNBC one time. You had Pat Buchanan from the right, Chris Matthews, who's sort of a liberal Democrat, and Lawrence O'Donnell's a liberal Democrat. And they all agreed that Bismarck was the original socialist because he introduced the Social Security system and unemployment insurance and whatnot. And so for them, socialism, social insurance, you know, a government program. But, you know, historically, socialism was economic democracy through social ownership. Ownership has two rights, the right to dispose of the surplus that's created and the right to make decisions, management decisions about what gets produced, how it's produced, and so forth. And without that democracy, you don't have socialism. You just have a government program. I mean, Bismarck, if you go read Marx and Engels about, you know, because even then some people were saying, oh, he's moving us towards socialism. I mean, they made so much fun of that. It's really a biting critique. So part of the problem, if you raise the word socialism, people think government versus private. And that's not what it was really about historically. What it really means is worker and community control. And that's not necessarily the state versus the market. That could be a co-op. You know, a co-op, in a worker co-op, you get your share of the surplus generated according to how much labor you contribute. If it's a consumer co-op, the idea is it operates at cost, and you get rebated any surplus in proportion to the purchases you make. So there's no exploitation going on there. You can find in capital. You know, Marx said that's half the problem, you know, how to dispose of the surplus. But then he said there were problems if they're competing in a market, because then you generate some of the dynamics we've been talking about that issue from competition. Historically, socialism as a movement is focused on exploitation and economic security. And one of the ways it got somewhat off track, I believe, is that it tended to get into the state versus private difference. So they often set up bureaucratic forms of state ownership and programs like Social Security or nationalized industries that really didn't have worker and community control. And you get a state elite that operates them in their own interests. That's been a problem with historical socialism. At the same time, throughout the history of socialism, there's been an ecological undercurrent. You can find in their books, there are whole books about this. There's a book called Marx's Ecology, where they recognize that nature was the underlying basis of the economy, and that, you know, what socialism was doing was not only harmonizing human with human, but humanity with nature. And they talk about problems of soil erosion and resource destruction. Back in the 19th century, probably the most prominent ecological socialist was William Morris, who also dealt with the problem of alienation. And he envisioned, like people like Kropotkin did and others, a socialist society where it was humanly scaled. A lot of the production was local, making it more amenable to democratic control. And in you know, our era, two prominent people who have made this kind of argument are E.F. Schumacher, Small is Beautiful, who comes sort of out of the social democratic tradition, the Labour Party tradition in Britain. And that's a book probably many of you have looked at. And at the end, he's got some, at the end of that book, he's got some outlines of what we mean by socialism and how it's relevant to environmental sustainability. And then, of course, Murray Bookchin, who was more out of the anarchist tradition and also envisioned a decentralized kind of democratic socialism in the economy. So those are sort of the broad ideas of what an ecological socialism would be, in contrast to a capitalism, which, oh, and I forgot the second form of extermination. There's the irrational exterminism when you issue out, you know, war and militarism. And then there's the very logical extermination that comes from an economy that grows without any sense of limit or reciprocity with the environment until it consumes the environment that sustains it. And that's a form of exterminism that is very logical, you know, systematic coming out of the system. So then the question is, okay, how do we talk about socialism when the popular sense is like Buchanan, Matthews, and O'Donnell on MSNBC, which, you know, that we can replicate many times when we listen to these kinds of discussions. And I think you don't begin to raise these issues by stamping socialism on your forehead and saying, we need socialism. because, you know, the popular response is, well, you're just talking about a state bureaucracy, and what about my freedom, and, you know, all the things that are in the popular political culture. I think the way we begin to raise these things are with what's called a transitional program or a program of non-reformist reforms, concrete popular demands that people think make sense on their own terms, like the right to health care. You know, single payer is socialized insurance. A health service like Britain has or Costa Rica has or Cuba has is a socialized, not just the insurance, but the whole medical system with your medical personnel delivering the services working on a salary for the system. And I think clean energy is another one where people are for it. And then what happens is, you know, the movement, as they begin to fight for these things and find out they're not getting it and getting irrational answers from the vested interests that don't want it, begin to see that these problems are systematic. And it's not just a matter of persuading people. It's a matter of taking the power from these vested interests and democratizing the power so we can get what we really need. And then so you start with common sense demands, and as people get in the movement, they begin to see what's really going on and realize we got to have systemic change. What we did in this campaign that Gloria was referring to is we kind of summed that up as the Green New Deal. And we felt if we used the phrase New Deal, that, you know, for the, in New York especially, which had the tradition of the New Deal, we had a New Deal in New York before it went national with when Roosevelt and Harry Hopkins and the others went down to, and Francis Perkins to Washington. They were doing some of that in New York. And that's why people vote for the Democratic Party. They think they still stand for that when they obviously don't if you really look at it. And what that means is we got to defend the parts of the old New Deal program which are worth defending, the social insurance, you know, the Social Security income, the Medicare, the Medicaid, those kinds of programs that provide social benefits. Another part of that program, which never got fully implemented but was raised in the first Social Security Act, it was deleted so the bill could pass, and then Roosevelt brought it back in his Economic Bill of Rights speech to Congress in 1944, State of the Union address, the right to a job. They called that employment assurance. It would have generalized the Works Progress Administration so that instead of going to unemployment offices, you go to employment offices and say, I want my job if you don't have a job in the private sector. And those jobs are planned locally and federally funded. Another part of the New Deal was public enterprise where private enterprise is failing. And they had in some of the jobs programs production for use, and they were actually competing with the private sector. Now we do that through prisons, which is not where we want to go. TVA, you know, where the private industry would not develop the electricity in Appalachia. The Rural Electric Administration, which organized rural electric co-ops because the private IOUs, investor-owned utilities, would not string the wires out to these rural areas because it wasn't profitable or as profitable. So those are things. We defend the old New Deal, and then we want to take it further, green the New Deal. And that would mean ecology and democracy. You know, the democracy is something to counter the tendency toward bureaucratization where the bureaucrats take on an interest of their own. For example, in the healthcare thing, we actually have three single-payer bills in Congress. Now, the one most people know is 676, which is a national health insurance plan. That goes right back to the New Deal. Then you got the one that Wellstone put in when he realized we might not get it nationally, but we should enable it for states. That's now the Sanders bill. And then there's a third bill, which back in the early 70s, the debate was between a health service, national health insurance, that was a Kennedy bill, the health service was the Dellums bill, and Nixon's bill, which is employer mandate, which is far to the left of what we got now with Obama. And the whole debate has shifted, so we didn't even talk about the health service. But I like that, and that's a bill that Barbara Lee keeps introducing, and she has no co-sponsors. It's just sort of to keep the tradition alive. But that was developed by the Medical Committee for Human Rights coming out of the Civil Rights Movement and wanted to democratize. They wanted a democratic model of administering health so that you would have community health boards elected, two-thirds by the community, one-third by healthcare workers, and they would administer it, and then those boards would elect people to state boards and then a national board. So it was a bottom-up control of a health service that would be responsive to the people, not bureaucrats. And out of the 60s, we got a lot of proposals like that. Same thing for public power, which a lot of us have been working on to municipalize public power, and you would federate those at the state and then the national level and plan out the electric system and the gas and the energy system from below. So that's what we mean by democracy, not just bureaucratic state programs, but democratically worker and community controlled programs and industries. And then the green investments. You know, I talked about the stagnation we've got now. We've built out a whole infrastructure. Instead of making tangible investment, new means of production that would employ people, they're speculating to rearrange who owns what we already have in terms of means of production. What we need now are green investments to get to a clean energy system, mass transportation, energy efficiency in our homes, and all the manufacturing and services that would support that building out that new infrastructure. I think that's how we can get the economy going now. And I think these are the kinds of demands that we have that are consistent with an ecological socialism and can bring that back into discussion without trying to, you know, sort of beat it into people with slogans, because I don't think that will work. So that is a very fast, tour through a bunch of propositions about both capitalism and ecological socialism. Under neoliberalism, the argument of the capitalists is we can't afford regulation, we can't afford investment in the social programs that we might want to restore. So how do we answer that argument? Well, the neoliberals are partly right. If they want to take profits, what they've done is financialize, because, as I said, there are not so many opportunities for tangible investment that generates profits. And to the extent it does, it's overseas. So we got trade agreements. Glass-Steagall removed a barrier to financialization when it was removed, as well as a whole lot of other deregulations of the financial sector. And so in a sense, you know, we have to say, you're right, you're not going to make profits. But our argument is it has to be publicly directed to get into the things we need, which are those green investments. So while we defend, you know, regulations that make sense on their own terms and fund social programs that benefit people, we also say we need structural change. We need more public generation of investment. I mean, what I say is by taxing the rich and investing it in socially useful investments, we can make better use of the money than they are with their speculations, which are just rearranging who owns what. I think we don't want to counterpose what we can do locally in our municipalities to what needs to be done in a larger systematic scale. So there are things we can do to get more control of our local economy that are consistent with systematic change, like public power, like getting home rule on taxation. Say here in New York, you know, we got a property tax and a sales tax at the county level, but the state keeps the income tax, which is the most progressive tax. And we have a more progressive system. We need to shift more of the taxation to income. Also, you know, we can reform the property tax to deal with site value rather than improvements, which discourages improvements. So there are a lot of things we can do there. And if we get home rule on those things, we can begin to make some improvements without saying that's sufficient in and of itself. Another thing I think we have to realize is that the question of capitalism versus socialism is not planning versus market. You're going to have some mix. There were markets long before there was capitalism. As we socialize production and democratize the appropriation and distribution of surplus, there's still going to be a lot of it where you want market distribution. And I won't go into a whole discussion. I think Michael Harrington in some of his books on socialism made a strong case for socializing and democratizing and planning investment, but allowing consumer goods to be priced by the market. And you get a more effective, efficient way of determining demand there. And you can go beyond that to some goods should be free. So we have free access to the roads, although with the neoliberals wanting us to privatize everything, they want to put toll booths everywhere and collect rent, for, you know, unearned income from us to use our social property. We got to look at capitalism as a system and the problems it generates by its very structure, and the problems beyond that, because it creates irrationalities that take on their own illogic, as E.P. Thompson used to talk about in Exterminism, and begin to think about alternative systematic change. To say that, you know, this kind of bottom-up administration of the economy never happened, I think, is not true. The Spanish Revolution had, you know, massive expropriation by workers and peasants, and they had a collectivized economy that operated pretty well for a year. Of course, they were fighting, on the one hand, Franco's fascists, and on the other hand, the Popular Front, the communists were leading, saying it's not time for the revolution now. First, we got to beat Franco, and they fought the workers who had taken over things. So they were caught in a vice, but it wasn't an economic problem. The Russian Revolution, you know, as Hannah Arendt points out in covering all kinds of revolutions, when the old system breaks down, you have a popular revolution. People form ways of administering the economy. You know, Chile, even when they elected Allende, his slogan was, we have to make haste slowly. Because on the one hand was Pinochet ready to bring down the hammer. On the other side was a popular movement that was forming neighborhood committees and workers' councils and pushing democratization of the economy from below. So I think there's evidence that that can happen. And, you know, the limitation of working strictly bioregionally and locally is that you're still embedded in market networks and an environmental system that's bigger than just that locality. And so you've got to have a way of relating to other localities. And I think a bottom-up structure that's indicative of is something that we should be thinking of. I mean, I think one of the things the anarchist wing of socialism brought that the statist wing didn't is the idea of federation from below. One of the debates when you talk about models is how much worker control, how much community control. And something that Gar Alperowitz, another guy worth reading on this, and Murray Bookchin also pointed out is that in any modern economy, only about 40% of the people are working. And the rest are children, disabled, elders, or people involuntarily unemployed. So if you want something that's really democratic, you got to have the final say by the community. And then the workers who are working respond to their demands for goods and services, and they manage their own work. And then work, there's a difference between wage slavery and work where you're producing for the common good and for your own satisfaction. I mean, that's where the disalienation that Marx talked about when he was young, and William Morris, who envisioned a kind of socialism where everybody was a craftsperson, you know, with a skill and took pride in their work. You're a carpenter, right? You get pleasure out of, you know, good work. I even get pleasure out of unloading trucks, right? I used to work in construction, but I didn't have a pension in health care. So, you know, any job you can take pride in. And I think people want to feel that they're pulling their own weight in society. So I don't think, you know, demanding jobs is problematic. It is problematic if everybody's supposed to get a job when, you know, less than half the people are actually going to work even under a full employment economy. So I kind of like, you know, we need to have both, you know, income supports and, you know, the citizens' dividend idea that, you know, because there's so much social investment in creating, you know, as Teddy Roosevelt of all people said, you know, public investments in infrastructure are the public avenues of private commerce. I mean, everybody benefits from that, and they paid for it with their taxes. Therefore, they should have a right to the income that's generated by those common investments. I think that's a rationale we can make for the citizens' dividend or the guaranteed annual income. Now I sort of want to take the other side of the argument and say there's a lot we can do locally, a lot of times more than we think, in terms of producing in the economy we have today. There's a very interesting book by Kirkpatrick Sale called Human Scale. And he systematically went through a lot of the things that could be produced locally at economies of scale with current technology. And it's not in his book, but there's another guy who's a late economist, Steve Marglin, who pointed out that we have large factories not because they're necessary for economies of scale, for efficient production, but in order to control labor. And that the scales where you reach your efficiencies are much smaller than we thought. So Sale points out you could produce a lot of things locally and reach all the technological scales of efficiency. Kropotkin had a book on Fields, Farms, and Workshops, something like that, where he did that in an earlier technological stage that's interesting. So I think by either co-ops or municipal enterprises, we can begin to start producing a lot of things locally, economically, in a way that, you know, we can afford what we're producing and somewhat delink from global markets and these bad trade agreements and whatnot. We can't do it all because it is very interrelated, but I think we can do a lot more than we think, and those are things we can do when we talk about electing our people to municipal office, which brings up Tom's issue, and that is he's raising the question of power. You know, we make demands on power and we expect the people in power to implement them because it makes sense, and that gets into the problem of vested interests who have interests different than our own. And so, you know, what what's central to the transitional program. You raise these demands, you build a movement, but it's about getting the power to actually implement them. And the people in power are not going to. Now, you know, I think Egypt is an interesting example. They go in Tahrir Square, they make demands, they get rid of Mubarak, but the military regime is still there. There's still 2 million people that are being paid by the regime to spy on other people. The Brotherhood, which was sort of a tolerated opposition, is now being brought in as a junior partner, and the more secular left youth and worker forces are being marginalized by that coalition. So that is ongoing struggle. But I think, you know, what people are realizing is we don't just want to replace Mubarak with another military leader. We got to change the system and democratize it. And I think people realize that in the course of struggling for, you know, they had simple demands, you know, some economic improvements and some political freedoms. And they're beginning to realize to get them, they got to get the power, and that the regime's got to be changed fundamentally, not just a few leaders at the top. But going back to municipal level, we can start building local bases of power, which give us credibility, a record, and experience that we can then, you know, use as a platform for taking on bigger scales of power. On the question of scale, we have to realize that capitalism is a centralizing system. It systematically centralizes control of the economy. So we got to deal with that as a system, even if we are advocating more local control, smaller scales of production and distribution. So I don't think we can avoid that. And the Tea Party, you know, it's interesting. Their argument is don't confiscate the fruit of my labor in the form of taxes. And I think the left criticism is to the capitalists, don't confiscate the fruit of my labor in the form of exploitation. So the discussion we got to have with the Tea Partiers is who's really taking more of your money? And if those numbers that I cited from those British economists are correct, half the time you spend at work, you're giving your money away before you pay any taxes. And, you know, I think that's something we can begin having some conversations about.
A number of interesting points from Howie Hawkins there. He doesn't clarify how the growth or die urge arrives. That is, of course, through interest on money. And we're going to hear some more about the history of money systems in the US in a second hour. Ellen Brown's going to be speaking on Web of Debt. I don't think it makes a lot of sense to consider the economic sphere as separate from the legal or the political. I think they're all so interlocked nowadays that anything which has a major decentralizing force on the economy will also do so on the political system and the legal system. And of course, my mind was buzzing with alternatives involving decentralizing the money system. Bitcoin has done that to a certain extent, and I looked on the web the other week, and there are hundreds and hundreds of people taking bitcoins. I still think an attack may be planned on that system, but it's a step in the right direction. But of course, it's still in the scarcity money model. It's still assuming self-interest of its parties to the exclusion of other interest. And now we're going to hear a presentation by G. Edward Griffin. I think this is from 1975 or 76. So his points about the interlocking of economies and the supranational organization of finance and business are, of course, only amplified. The last three or four decades have been an era of great consolidation and harmonization of laws. They've been subjugated to international treaties without the pretense of democracy. This is G. Edward Griffin on the myth and meaning of monopoly capitalism.
You know, there's an old adage that says, what we don't know cannot hurt us. Well, that's really not true, is it? What we don't know can hurt us, but there's something even worse than not knowing something. I'd like to amend that statement to say, what we do know that simply isn't so can hurt us even more. It's not what we don't know that's the problem. It's what we do know that is false. And I'd like to devote my remarks this morning to just one example of that truth. Now, one of the things that we all know, because we've all heard it over and over again, is this. Monopoly is the end product of free enterprise capitalism. Monopoly is the extreme form of free enterprise capitalism. And monopoly, therefore, is inevitable in a system of free enterprise capitalism. Now that, ladies and gentlemen, is something that we all know that simply is not so. I think it's probably best just to get off on the same foot, all of us together, to define monopoly. Different dictionaries give different definitions, but the one on my desk says that monopoly is a condition or a situation that exists where it is possible for one person or a group of persons or corporation, an entity, one single entity, to have exclusive rights of production or offering services so that it is possible to charge a higher price than would be possible or that would be fixed by open competition. Now, there's no controversy on that. We all have a pretty good idea of what monopoly is. And I think probably one of the best examples of a monopolist in history can be found by studying the case history of old John D. Rockefeller I. As you undoubtedly know, John D. built the first oil monopoly in the world in the 1870s. And he did that on the philosophy, and this is a direct quote attributed by many of Rockefeller's biographers, a direct quote attributed to him himself. He used to say over and over again, "Competition is a sin." Rockefeller's whole life was devoted to one goal, and that was the elimination of competition, and thus the creation of monopoly. One of the better biographers of John D. Rockefeller was John T. Flynn. And in his book called God's Gold, he explains what I've just said this way. Flynn said, quote, "His entry into business and his career after that would be in a large measure the story of American economic development and the war against laissez-faire. Rockefeller was definitely convinced that the competitive system under which the world had operated was a mistake. It was a crime against order, efficiency, economy. It could be eliminated only by abolishing all rivals. His plan, therefore, took a solid form. He would bring all his rivals in with him. The strong ones he would bring in as partners. The others would come in as stockholders. Those who would not come in would be crushed." End quote. And when you examine the entire life and career of John D. Rockefeller, you soon see that this analysis is 100% accurate in everything that Rockefeller did. And so we must observe in passing that monopoly, the essence of monopoly, is not free enterprise competition, but in fact just the opposite from it. It is the escape from competition that is the essence of monopoly. It's a very fundamental fact that is not, unfortunately, is not taught or not made clear in the high schools and the universities of our land. It was certainly not made clear to me when I went through school, and it wasn't until just a few years ago, really, that the full impact of this truth finally made itself known to me. Okay, enough for monopolies. What about cartels? A cartel is not too much different from a monopoly, except perhaps on a grander scale. A cartel is a grouping, generally it's a grouping of corporate interests who are seeking to escape competition between themselves. Quite often the cartel exists across international boundaries, but it may not necessarily involve more than one nation. As long as we have a grouping of separate corporate interests seeking to eliminate competition between themselves, we're dealing here with a cartel. Now, the way in which they do this is by entering into a series of cartel agreements. The specific objectives of these agreements are to eliminate competition in certain specific areas. For instance, several large corporations or groupings of corporations will come together and agree not to violate certain price structures. Now, that's the most obvious form of a cartel or a monopoly agreement, not to charge a price lower than a certain agreed-upon level. Or they may agree to divide up world markets. They may agree, for instance, to give a certain conglomerate the North American rights to manufacture and distribute, whereas another grouping will have the rights in Asia or Africa, and still a third grouping will have the rights of Europe, and so forth. They may agree to divide among themselves certain products. They may agree, for instance, that this grouping of companies will remain in oil and petroleum products, such as Standard Oil of New Jersey, and Standard Oil's partner IG Farben in Germany would agree, therefore, to have an exclusive right to all things pertaining to chemicals and drugs. And these two giants, IG Farben and Standard Oil of New Jersey, can come together and agree not to step on each other's toes. In fact, they can agree, as they did, that whenever Standard Oil would go into the business of drugs or commercial chemicals, they would do so jointly with IG Farben in jointly owned corporations. And Farben, in turn, agreed if ever they went into the field of oil or petroleum products, they would do so jointly with Standard Oil. And so by the layering, one upon the other, of these cartel agreements, gradually the areas of competition between the conglomerates or between the monopolistic structures, those areas of competition are narrowed and narrowed until finally the ultimate end of this process is that they no longer compete in any way. They are, for all practical purposes, as one. It may be that in this process and in the ultimate stage, they will remain separately owned. They'll have separate corporate stockholders. Officers of the various groups will be separate, but they will move as one because they will be locked together, arm in arm, by so many cartel agreements that nothing they do, insofar as facing the consumer market is concerned, nothing they do is outside of the cartel agreement. And so the end process of that cartel concept, therefore, the ultimate extension is a one-world corporate entity. It is also important for us to realize when we're looking at cartels that the participants of necessity always will abandon their national loyalties. They become true supranationals. I use the word supranationals rather than internationals because international implies an interaction between nations, whereas supranationals, that term implies rising above the concept of national states. And this is exactly what these people consider themselves to be, is above national loyalties. Let's just take an example. The Ford Motor Company and its empire is probably one of the better examples that we could look at as an example of international cartel. It is a matter of historical record that the Ford Motor Company became interlocked with many other corporations around the world through a series of cartel agreements over the past years. Prior to World War II, they became intensely interlocked with IG Farben, which I mentioned a moment ago. And through that interlock, they became tied in with Standard Oil of New Jersey and through DuPont and other corporations elsewhere in the world also. But in a particular example, we're looking at the Ford Motor Company of Germany, and we find that the IG Farben cartel there owned 40% of the stock of Ford Motor Germany. And Karl Bosch and Karl Krauch, who were the two top executives of IG Farben in Germany, sat on the board of directors of the Ford Motor Company in Germany. In return, we find that Edsel Ford in the United States was appointed to the board of directors of the American IG, which was the American holding corporation for the interests of IG Farben in this country. And so that just gives you a quick little glimpse of how the interlocking directorate can take place between large corporations. The significance of that is this, that during World War II, when Nazi Germany and the United States were engaged in deadly war, the German-based Ford Company continued to operate completely independent. This is amazing, because when the war broke out, or when the Nazis consolidated their power in Germany to launch the war, one of the first things they did was to nationalize or confiscate all foreign-owned industry in Germany. All foreign-owned industry was nationalized, and it was incorporated into the Hermann Goering Werk. But the Ford Motor Company was not. It was allowed to continue operating independently. Why? Part of the answer comes to us from the records of the Nuremberg trials. Very interesting documents to read there. If you have some spare time on a rainy Sunday afternoon, go down to your library and get them out, read them. You'll be amazed what you'll learn about international cartels and monopolies. In the testimony at Nuremberg, Karl Crouch, who was the head of IG Farben, testified as follows, quote, "I myself knew Henry Ford and admired him. I went to see Goering personally about that. I told Goering that I myself knew his son Edsel, too, and I told Goering that if we took the Ford independence away from them in Germany, it would aggrieve friendly relations with American industry in the future." In the future, notice. See, they're looking beyond the war. "I counted on a lot of success for the adaptation of American methods in German industries, but that could be done only in friendly cooperation. Goering listened to me, and then he said, 'I agree. I shall see to it that the Deutsche Fordwerk will not be incorporated in the Hermann Goering Werk.' Thus," he said, "we succeeded in keeping the Fordwerk working and operating independently." End quote. Of course, this also happened in Nazi-occupied France. All the while that the war was going on, the Ford Motor Company in France was manufacturing trucks and military hardware for the Nazis, and that too was operating independently. And all during this time, the managers of the Ford Motor in France were carrying on correspondence with or sending reports to Edsel Ford in the United States, telling him what kind of progress was being made, how much profit was being made, and what rosy picture was being painted for the future. For instance, Maurice Dollfuss, who was the chairman of the board of the Ford Motor Company in France, the French subsidiary, sent a letter just before the war broke out to Edsel Ford, and he said this, quote, "The attitude you have taken, together with your father, of a strict neutrality, has been an invaluable asset for the production of your companies in Europe." Now, that was just before the war broke out. Of course, everybody knew it was going to break out because the German war machine had been in the process of mobilization for many, many months, and all of the plants were producing military hardware. The troops were being amassed for training and moved to the borders. So it came as no great surprise to anyone. And then after the war broke out, we see that it made no difference either, because 2 months after Pearl Harbor, and after an official declaration of war between the United States and Nazi Germany, Dollfuss reported to Edsel Ford the 1941 net profits of the operation at 58 million francs. And then in his letter he said, quote, "Since the state of war between the USA and Germany, I am not able to correspond with you very easily. I have asked Lesto to go to Vichy and mail this. We are continuing our production as before. The financial results for the year are very satisfactory. We have formed our African company." And then he goes on to give further details of the business. And so I repeat something we have to keep in mind, that it is absolutely impossible for those engaged in international cartels, or these multinational corporations as we now call them,